Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuham.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on Monday.
Monday, April 29th.
April kind of zoomed by.
Yeah.
And suddenly, it's summer.
It's 90 degrees today.
Well, not quite 90. Did it get up to 90?
87. Which is like 90.
All right, so it's quite warm outside, which is bad for the tree peonies.
I don't even know what that means.
Tree peony is a kind of peony.
Okay.
Not the normal peonies you see all the time.
Oh, right.
They are beautiful. Mm. They are exquisite. But it has caused this burst of 80s, close to 90s temperature makes them bloom fast and die. What you want is some warm weather to get them going.
Yeah.
And then once they start to bloom, like you need slightly cool weather to keep them pretty longer.
Yes.
So sad for the tree peonies, but warm for a lot of, comfortable for a lot of other creatures.
One thing I learned from what they call the CS, whatever, our subscription in the farm. One thing I've learned is that you can't count on nature. Everything's a headache.
It's constant state of flux.
Yeah, it's something's always not working out. It's too cold, it's too hot, it's too wet, it's too dry, whatever. You got to live with that.
But the tree peonies, if you look at them today,
yeah,
in our yard,
yeah,
exquisite.
All right, I'll do that. In any event, you have just come back from a trip.
Right.
And here's your chance. Here's your chance to talk about that.
Well, Sadie allowed me to go with her to Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a friend who lived in Copenhagen for a while and gave her a bunch of suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached out to a couple of people. Sadie planned this trip. Basically, she decided we would go to... We'd start in Stockholm, Sweden, and then go to Copenhagen. And so turned out our friendly dentist had just been to Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent me a list of things, ideas, places to go, restaurants, museums, etc. And then also our friends, Martine and Don, have a son who lives and works in Stockholm, and they've been over there. So Martine gave me some ideas of places to go, things to see, etc., things to eat. And so armed with this and not much else, we headed over. Sadie and I are not big trip planners. We did not have a big itinerary. And we just kind of let it fall into place once we got there. But, it's good and bad. So we had some good adventures. We stayed in a really wonderful, affordable hotel in Stockholm, the Mornington. And it was just charming in a kind of cool Scandinavian way, and had a really good gym. An amazing gym, and all kinds of good stuff, centrally located. So that worked out well. So I highly recommend the Mornington. And, the first day we got to Stockholm, we had the whole jet lag, exhausted, been awake for, 48 hours kind of situation. And so that was a little bit rough. Nonetheless, we managed to hobble down to a fantastic food hall, really upscale. And we had a late lunch, and I did have Swedish meatballs. And they were good. Did you ever have Swedish meatballs?
No.
It was all the rage during like the 60s in a chafing dish at every party. Americans served these little Swedish meatballs. And they seemed like just kind of a cliche. But turns out, in Sweden at least, they're really tasty. So we did lots of fun things in Sweden. We went on a boat tour. And again, it was, I have to point out, weather, freezing. Not even freezing, below freezing. Okay, when we arrived there, it was 0 Celsius. Mm-hmm. All right, and our phones told us that the first day we were running around feels like 23 degrees.
Fahrenheit.
Yeah. Okay, and it was snowing. All right, so it seems like an incredible step in the wrong direction,
right,
to go from the burst of spring that was happening here in Limeport to the sub freezing temperatures of Stockholm. So, but we did some pretty normal stuff. We went to a royal palace, and that was okay. It's sort of interesting. And what else did we do? We went to the Vasa Museum. Now, I was totally lukewarm about the Vasa Museum. It's a big old ship that somebody has conserved. And turns out it was terrific. Absolutely terrific. I mean, you're staring at me in disbelief. And you're probably thinking you would never, in a million years, go to the Vasa Museum. But it, I can tell you what it is. It's not going to rock your world. It's a boat that first set sail in like 1628. And it didn't even make it out of the harbor. All right? It was top heavy and it just tilted over and sank on the very first, on the maiden voyage. And it was underwater in the mud for 300 years. And then somebody kind of bumped into it. And during the 50s and 60s, they decided to bring it up. And somehow they did it. And it was amazingly preserved. And they say that's because the water in that area was too low in salt to support the life of the kind of worms that usually eat wood in underwater situations. Also, all sewage and trash was just dumped into the harbor. And so there was too much pollution. So between the pollution and the salt, the wood-eating critters...
The lack of salt.
The lack of salt. Mm. The salt situation. This thing was preserved. They even had... Of one sail, they had like 70% of the sail.
Mm-hmm.
That cloth in the water, 300 years. Seems unbelievable. So they had, it was a huge thing. It was covered with the sculptures. You could go up and look at it from every possible vantage point. They had pictures of, the deep sea divers in the 60s. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
guys in like the astronaut suits with the big metal ball on their heads. Mm-hmm. Those are the divers that were going down to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk about it, it sounds a little too historical or scientific or whatever, but it was just really, really interesting. Only they say it seemed like to really rock and roll needed, 200 to 400 people on the boat. Despite that, there were only 4 toilets. But anyway,
yeah.
Only 30 or 40 people seem to have died during when it sank. And they had recovered bones from the people who died. And they had analyzed them. And they had exhibitions of, for each group of bones, what this person probably looked like, what they ate. And they could tell by what they ate, whether it was meat, milk, and other things, or just porridge, how wealthy they were, what possible level of job or whatever they had on the boat. So it was pretty interesting. Okay, but anyway, so that's the museum experience. Other good food we had, again, at that beautiful food hall was a seafood restaurant called Lisa Elmquist. And just wonderful. We had a marvelous meal there. One thing led to another, and suddenly we're flying to Copenhagen, which was south, which was a relief. And so the temperature was a little bit warmer there, in the 40s, Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And again, we did some more shopping. We looked at because of the grandchildren situation, we looked at a lot of Scandinavia baby clothes, mm-hmm. which are very cute. The problem with Scandinavia, everything's expensive.
Really?
So you think twice before you buy something. Mm-hmm. And so I can't say we did a lot of buying. But we went to fancy department stores and trying to get an idea of, you know, the sense of style for home decor mm-hmm. is so beautiful mm-hmm. In both countries. So we were looking at the different home stores and seeing, you know, what was cool. Mm-hmm. And so that was fun. We had in Copenhagen possibly the nicest Airbnb I've ever rented. Mm-hmm. It had an exquisite view of what's called the King's Garden, this park across the street. And every morning we would hear the changing of the guard, and there would be a parade of these guys, you know, going down the street, in the middle of the street, marching and, you know, drumming away. There was a royal palace there. We had a tour of the royal palace. Next to that was the what you might call the National Danish Art Museum, the SMK. Beautiful building. Old neoclassical building in the front. Modern Danish addition on the back. Very cool. Full of light. And just a beautiful place to look at art. And got to see a lot of Scandinavian artists that I sort of knew a little bit about, was able to see much more. One of the things you do in Sweden is have fika, and that's like afternoon tea. They even say that pretty much, I read somewhere that the big meal of the day is in the middle of the day, mm-hmm. and you don't necessarily have much of a dessert at all. The restaurants are not famous for their desserts, and because at 3 o'clock or something in the afternoon, you sit down, you have a cup of coffee, and you have a really nice dessert then. Mm-hmm. And it's called fika. So that was a fun thing to do as well. And one day we did our fika in a sort of a Roman temple kind of building that's been turned into a cafe in the King's Garden called the Hercules Pavilion. Mm-hmm. Great people watching, etc.
Didn't you see everybody was on bicycles?
In Copenhagen, big bike traffic, mm-hmm. you know, and you would see people clearly commuting on their way something with lights on their helmets, mm-hmm. You know, in the dark of the morning. And during rush hour, there would be just these mobs of bikes in the bike lane. They had a fair, you know, bike lanes on every street, mm-hmm. and it seemed to be a very fit country. Mm-hmm. I will say that we did not see a lot of obesity. Fika and Danish pastry notwithstanding.
Really?
Yeah. So that was interesting. We had a nice boat tour in Copenhagen too, and we went by. Remember in the last podcast, I talked about how the old stock exchange burned down. Mm-hmm. We went right by it in the mm-hmm. boat, and cranes were digging up the remains, and it was still smoldering. Got an amazing view of that. So, you know, we had some really good adventures in Copenhagen. We also went up the Round Tower. It was an observatory. It was mm-hmm. built to be an observatory as an astronomical observatory mm-hmm. in 1742 or something, and it's 35 meters high. That's pretty high, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all a ramp, and it's that spirals around, which was good because that would have been a lot of stairs, mm-hmm. but to walk up it as a ramp wasn't that bad. And you know, once you get up there, you get the old 360 amazing view of the entire city. Hmm. Yeah. So we had some good adventures. We had some new kinds of food, and we had some traditional foods, like Italian food. We had pasta. So there you have it.
All right.
I don't know. Do you think you'd like to go?
Yeah, it doesn't sound bad. I mean, we're only there a week. And so on a week. I mean,
although I have to tell you, one funny thing is, one day we set out to do some shopping and see some sights. Mm-hmm. And so I was in charge of the itinerary to some extent, and we decided the first thing we do is go see the Little Mermaid statue, mm-hmm. you know, the famous...
in Denmark, yeah.
Yeah, in Copenhagen. And we marched and marched and marched. We finally got to this thing. I had Googled the wrong mermaid statue, and we walked all across town to not see the mermaid statue. And we ended up not seeing the other one, because by the time we got to this one, we were so far away
yeah.
from the famous one.
Yeah.
So that was like rookie mistake.
Next trip.
Yeah, next trip.
All right. Very good. Very good. Sounds good. Well, it's such a good time. But here's what you missed. You missed the NFL draft.
Yes. Yeah. How'd that go? Giants get anything worthwhile?
Yeah, you know, the deal with the draft is...
I know what the deal with the draft is. You're always very optimistic when it happens.
Well, because every team celebrates. As a matter of fact, one of the funniest things is that when they show the draft live, I haven't seen this too often, but I saw it this year, you know, what are you watching? They're showing the war rooms of each of the teams after they make a pick. They make a pick and they're all high-fiving each other. Like they did something, they accomplished something because they all agreed on the pick or something like that. And the truth is, they won't know for years whether these were the right picks, whether these were the right players. But each team celebrates their picks and talks about what was very exciting about the people they draft. And, you know, the fans get carried away with it. So, you know, the people rate the draft, they celebrate the draft.
Well, you don't seem carried away.
No, because here's why. I was reading an article in the Times which says NFL teams know the best way to draft. Why aren't they doing it? And the truth is, the best way to draft is to make trades to get as many picks as possible, including trading down. That's what you do. You say, I'm going to trade a first-round pick for a second and a fifth or something. And you mass the most possible picks. And that's the best way to draft. Now, why do I say that? Because this is in accordance with a scholarly paper done some years ago by Richard Thaler, who's an economics professor at the University of Chicago, and Cade Massey, a business professor at Duke. And Richard Thaler, you know, he's a Nobel Prize winner in behavioral economics. He's not, you know, small potatoes.
Yeah.
And what they determined based on their study of draft picks and the results of those draft picks or how those players panned out is that it is extremely difficult to judge talent. As they put it, teams overestimate their ability to delineate between stars and flops. And because they can't really evaluate people particularly well, they overvalue the right to choose in any particular point in the draft. In other words, you got 15, pick number 15. Well, pick number 15 may or may not be better than pick number 25 because there's a lot of randomness in the draft. And they prove this, you know, as one does when writing an economics paper, with data. So this data has been out there. And it's even been looked at by teams like the Dallas Cowboys. Jerry Jones hired someone who's an economist who's supposedly had studied this paper. So
how should you do it?
You should trade all your high picks for slightly lower picks. And instead of having 7 picks in the draft, rounds 1 to 7, you might end up with 12. And therefore, you increase your odds of landing good players. You've got 12 picks instead of 7. The odds go up that you have good players. That's clearly the conclusion of the study.
But no one can bring themselves to do this.
That's exactly right. So what's interesting is two things. Number one, it's kind of disappointing that Richard Thaler is writing papers on stuff like this. And it's sort of...
I'm sure he's written other papers.
He has, but...
Maybe once in a while he needs a break. He wants to do something fun.
This just kind of validates my choice not to become an economics professor. Become a lawyer
instead. Possible he didn't even write it, Daniel. It's possible one of his graduate...
He wrote it.
Wrote it, and he signed the paper.
Sadly, he wrote it. And but it's a behavioral experiment in itself, because scouts and team owners can't bring themselves to accept the conclusion that they're not good judges of talent. They don't care what the data shows. They said, and yet this time I know this guy will succeed.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, did when they presented his information. So this is very persuasive. And then he went and he picked and he traded up and he got fewer picks, but he knew who he wanted. And so it's kind of insane. I mean, that's the way teams are going to operate. People believe in themselves. And that's the way you market it. You market it to your fans. You say, we got great guys. We know it. We've spoken to them. They're the greatest. So it just runs against, you know, the kind of behavior people normally exhibit when they're managing an organization. The other thing that they concluded was it's much more valuable to trade picks for future picks. In other words, that you say, I'll trade my first-round draft pick for a second this year and a first next year. That kind of trade is normally available. Teams don't do it because they want immediate gratification and because the coaches aren't assured that they'll be there next year.
Mm-hmm.
So they operate against the interests of the team. They don't make those trades. I mean, there are some trades, but not as many as they want to have. So the Giants, by that test, failed because the Giants, there are seven rounds based on trades. Giants only had six picks. And for a team that needs a lot of players, that's not the way to succeed. So it's hard to be optimistic.
So that's why you're so glum.
I'm not glum. It's 90 degrees, honey. The other article about football that you missed was about Gaelic footballers. Gaelic football being a game they play in Ireland. It is the only game besides the NFL in which there are goalposts that people try to kick a ball through.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that in common.
Right.
Although the game they play, it's not a game I'm familiar with, Gaelic football. It's sort of a combination of rugby and soccer.
Yeah.
Well, someone got the idea that these fellas playing Gaelic football could be place kickers in the NFL. So there's been a group that's been working to develop some of these folks into place kickers. And there's real money in becoming an NFL player. So there's no shortage of Gaelic footballers who want to switch to the NFL. What? There's another, it's getting more attention now for two reasons. One is these guys can really kick. And the other is Gaelic football is, it's not like soccer where, you know, it being able to run really fast and whatever at a great length is at a premium, meaning that you can't be too heavy. Gaelic footballers are more like rugby. They're big guys. So the average kickers that they recruited to try out from Gaelic footballers were 6'3", 215 pounds. These are big guys. And they've changed the rules in the NFL for special teams so that there'll be more tackling on kickoffs and the like. So these guys are more attractive. The only thing is, apparently there's more to converting to the NFL than I seem to realize. That these, it takes years to practice and perfect the art of kicking a football that's snapped by a center to a holder to kick. It's not like they do it once and say, yeah, I can do that. It doesn't work that way.
Huh.
So they're all developmental projects. I don't understand that. But in any event, it's something to look forward to, Tamsin. Gaelic footballers in the NFL. How's that?
So, you know, not that I read deeply this week's Sunday Times.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm still in the fighting the jet lag.
Right.
Still recovering. Still doing laundry.
Yeah.
Et cetera. But I did notice that they had the big museum section.
Yes, they did have museum section.
In the Times. So I gave it a glance.
Yeah.
And I just saw some fun stuff that's around and coming around. One of them is, so it's a big, it's the 100th anniversary for the Morgan Library and Museum in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their exhibitions is Beatrix Potter and, Drawn from Nature. And so, you know, that's always fun stuff to look at. So that's there till June 9th. And the Morgan is, celebrating by opening up, their garden once again in the next couple days. Be nice. So that'd be a nice spring field trip. Go over to the Morgan Library, stroll around the garden, take a look at the Beatrix Potter stuff. Over at MoMA, tons of the stuff at MoMA, but what caught my eye, of course, is Kathy Kollwitz.
Did you say, of course?
Do you remember the one print in your parents' playroom of an older woman with her hand?
Yes, that's
Kollwitz.
Oh, okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that's a self-portrait even. So anyway, so that's is a big exhibition of her work till July 20th at the MoMA. Then there's something coming to, or I guess it's already at the New York Historical Society, called Lost New York, that is about, obviously, lost buildings in New York, places that have disappeared, like Penn Station, the old Penn Station, so forth. I'd really like to look at that. And I noted that in their ad, they said on Fridays, between 5 and 8, it's pay what you wish. This is at the New York Historical Society on 77th Street. And also there's music and food. Sounds like it'd be a fun field trip. Friday evenings, pay what you wish, with music and food. I don't think the food is free, but, you know, that would be fun.
The New York Historical Society?
New York Historical Society.
And where is that?
On, like, Central Park West and 77th Street.
Okay.
They have plenty of fun things to see there.
Okay.
So, and then, you know, the one place Sadie and I did not get to in Stockholm was the photography exhibition space / museum Fotografiska? I don't know how to say it, really. Which has other places all over. And the one in New York is having an exhibition of works by the photographer, I guess sort of recently discovered photographer, Vivian Mayer. I don't think it's opening until May 31st. But for fans of Vivian,
okay,
that would be fun to see.
All right. So there was an article called Streaming TV Becomes World of Watch, Cancel, Repeat for Nomadic Subscribers. And the point here is that
We all sign up for
these services.
And the companies count on us. Even though it's cancel any time, we never bother to cancel.
We never bother to cancel. But there are a bunch of savvy, maybe another word could be used, whatever it is, subscribers who have made it their business to closely monitor whatever their subscription service is and sometimes sign up with the idea they're going to watch one particular show. And then after 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, cancel it. And then they might sign up for that service again 2 months later.
What are these people like?
Younger
people?
Yeah, they're basically younger people. But because they're more conscious of money, possibly, and because they're more comfortable just signing up and canceling. It's whatever. But it is a thing. It's not like just three people who are friends with a reporter at the New York Times. They say...
Are you sure?
They say, and I'm going to give you a number. It's probably a made-up number, but in any event, it's a number. Less loyal subscribers, that's what they call them, introduce a whole new level of complexity to the business. Last year, these serial churners accounted for 40% of all new subscriptions and cancellations. 40%.
Well, I'm sure the 40% is made up.
Of course it's made up. But let's say it's in the order of 40%.
40% of all cancellations?
Yeah. 40% of new subscriptions and cancellations. Now, they're in the business of new subscriptions and cancellations, so it's not 40% of the people watching.
What do you mean new subscriptions and cancellations?
I'm reading you.
Those are two different things.
Tamsin, roughly 40%. I read you the sentence. You can take it for what it's worth. The point is...
Read it to me again.
It says that it accounted for roughly 40% of all new subscriptions and cancellations. That's literally what it says. Okay? Are you cross-examining me in the article?
No, I'm just saying it's a poorly written article.
Okay, there's a lot of that in the New York Times, but that's not the point. The point is, there are a bunch of people doing this, enough so that the streaming services are paying attention to this because it's hurting their business. They count on the idea that people sign up and forget about it and stay with it.
So we are the good bunnies.
Well, maybe, depending on how you look at it. But they say that's one of the reasons that you see the subscription services raising their fees, producing less material because they're less profitable than they used to be because people do cancel. On the other hand, They have an interview here with someone who does this kind of thing. And the quote, "I'm happy to cancel, to punish the companies who are making me do this." Punish because
there are
too
it.
Many yeah. services and it's a pain in the ass.
No, we have a bunch of stuff we're always going through and saying, we want to see this, we want to see this, we want to see this. And you say, no, we can't because we're not signing up for another
service.
That's
an example. And so they show someone and they do it, and this guy finally is convinced to do it, and they cancel 4 weeks later. So if we were to steel ourselves to do that kind of thing, we could be more adventurous. Think about it. Think about it.
You could do it.
And you could do it.
No, I already do all the cleaning up in the house.
All right.
Okay? I've got enough. That could be your like little
my finally
niche.
Making
it
a contribution,
your niche.
Making a financial
and you
contribution.
You would learn to do it, yeah. And then you could do it without even thinking about it. None of the cursing and screaming and what was the password? How do I get into this?
I don't think you can do it without the cursing and screaming. It's they don't mention the cursing and screaming here, but I'm sure that's part of it. Okay, and finally, we have a few obituaries. One of them, I'll just mention in passing, is Ken Holtzman, who threw two no-hitters for the Cubs in Oakland. I forget, maybe one for each team, but the point is he was considered, at the time, a top Jewish baseball player. There aren't too many Jewish baseball players. And a matter of fact, they make the point of describing a game he had where he pitched against Sandy Koufax and beat him, who was the ultimate Jewish baseball player. So there you go. You know, there are some Jewish baseball players. The Mets have a Jewish baseball player now.
Okay.
Well, or maybe. I mean, Harrison Bader, his father, is Jewish. I don't know how observant Harrison is, but, you know, he talks about it. So it's a thing. Then there were two other obituaries. One is Whitey Herzog. Whitey Herzog, who was the manager of the Kansas City Royals for several years, and then the St. Louis Cardinals. This is how I learned that Kansas City and St. Louis are pretty close to each other. Because he just went from one area to the other without much hiccup. Very successful, both, and he became a general manager too. Very, very successful. And the quote, his quote that's noted here, you know, he was a minor league ball player for a long time and then an unsuccessful major league ball player. The quote is, "Baseball has been good to me since I quit trying to play it," which I think is pretty much true. Sort of describes Herzog's career. And Carl Erskine died. Now, Carl Erskine was a pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers who was very well known at the time, very popular. Baseball was very popular in Brooklyn, etc. And what they pitched two no-hitters himself. What they note here about Erskine, I remember hearing this story before. They talk about the famous Bobby Thompson home run in 1951 when the Giants came from 13 games back and beat the Dodgers in the playoff because of the, quote, "shot heard around the world." Bobby Thompson hit a home run off a fellow named Ralph Branca, who was brought in to pitch to him, and that turned the tide, and the Giants won the game. Well, the story is this. The Dodgers were kind of out of pitching, and they're in the ninth inning. They're up by two runs, but they had starting pitchers in the bullpen to come in. They only had those two starters, and they were overworked. And they were warming up, and Erskine threw one pitch. He threw a curveball that bounced. And the coach from the Giants got on the phone with the manager of the Dodgers, got on the phone with the manager of the Dodgers and said, "You can't pitch Erskine. He's bouncing that curveball. Bring in Branca." And Branca gave the so-called "shot heard around the world," which he, you know, never was able to live down. And Erskine says, here's the way they put it. "Reflecting on having escaped the possibility of becoming Thompson's victim, Erskine would say, whenever I'm asked what my best pitch was, I say that curveball that I bounced in the bullpen." Well, it's probably true. All right. So that's
so I have some bottom line stuff about the travel.
Yeah, I'll go ahead.
Okay, and number one is we use no cash. We change no money.
All right.
Okay.
That doesn't surprise me. That seems
surprising. I know it doesn't surprise you. I'm a little
shocked.
I know
shocked.
We have,
cash
you know, no, I didn't.
But you had some euros with you, and you
no, I didn't have euros with me. I had British pounds.
Oh, okay.
And those I used in Heathrow
because
I was just trying to get rid of them.
Yeah, sure.
But we, so we did that. Number two, English was not a problem anywhere. Now, we were flattered that very often people spoke Swedish or Danish to us.
Because you guys like, look Swedish
like we
and
were
Danish.
Part of the, you know,
right.
crowd. But the English, you know, it was amazing how fluidly people could switch from Swedish or Danish to English, and very smooth English. And, you know, it was, you know, that made life pretty painless for us. Also, we had a very good experience with the Danish metro. I mean, our Airbnb was a 5-minute walk from the metro station that went directly to the airport. Like you just walk through the airport, get a ticket, hop on. You don't even have to, you know, airport stops the end of the line. So you just hop on any train that comes and head out. And it was a 15-minute ride to, you know, this kind of the center of town. So, you know, it was very smooth sailing in terms of...
This is Denmark we're talking about.
Yeah, in Denmark. But, I mean, generally, logistically, very smooth sailing for all, you know, for some of the things you worry about when you travel. So.
Well, I think also your hotel worked out, your Airbnb worked out. And, you know, you and I are great believers in Airbnb and or Vrbo, whatever. I mean, I think we do pretty well with that.
Yeah, this was huge. Mm-hmm. It was huge. It was beautiful. It was extremely clean. It was centrally located. And originally, we came upon it because the hotels were just so, were looking so expensive in Copenhagen.
Well, that's one of the things with Airbnbs. They tend to be in neighborhoods. When you say centrally located,
it wasn't in a neighborhood per se. I mean, it was right in the middle. It was, you know, very touristic area. Okay. Uh-huh. It wasn't a cute, charming neighborhood or anything like that. But it was just, it also allowed us to, you know, really kind of stretch out. When you're traveling together for a while, it can be a drag to be just always stuck in the same room together every minute. So. That was nice. All right. Well, that's all I have to say about that. And now I can relax, finish the laundry, and get ready for the next adventure.
Okay. Ready for the next adventure. All right. So until then, this is Dan Abuhoff.
And Tamsin Granger.
For Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.
Right.
See you next time.
Have a hygge sort of day.
Ooh, I don't even know what that means.